And welcome to the New York Society Library. We're very excited to meet Graham Robb. My name is Lawrence Bergreen. I'm a trustee of the library, and I'm delighted to see you all here. Just wanted to say a few words to introduce Graham Robb to you. But before I do, I was asked to talk about the New York Society Library Annual Fund. Please make a contribution. Membership fees cover only 22% of the library's general operating costs, and of course your support is tax deductible, so thank you very much. Okay, Graham Robb, if you read today's New York Times profile of Mr. Robb, you know what a fascinating book and author this is, and I was really jolted by reading it. I was familiar with an earlier book of his, a biography of Victor Hugo, and this one seems to go into another realm of meta-biography or meta-history, if you will, that seems really compelling and fascinating. Once in a while, a book comes along that's part visionary and part investigative that can't be summarized in just one sentence. That's an entire world unto itself. And the discovery of Middle Earth seems to me to be such a book, and it's a really rich reading experience, as I'm sure you all know, because that's why you're here this evening. Just a few words about Graham Robb. He is the author of three prize-winning books, biographies. The New York Times selected each one as one of the best books of the year, and his most recent books are The Discovery of France and Parisians. He lives on the Anglo-Scottish border. Maybe Mr. Robb will tell us a little bit more about that. I was also deeply impressed by one particular aspect of the New York Times profile, which mentioned that Mr. Robb doesn't own a car, but is a, quote, fanatical bicyclist. So I thought that was very much to his credit. That often reminds me of a metaphor for writing. I'm very delighted to introduce and present Graham Robb to you. Thanks very much. Bye.
I hope you'll let me know if you can't hear me clearly enough. I don't feel jet lagged, but my voice does, I think. That was very kind of you to make the book sound rational. And excuse me. This is the kind of book that would normally be written by a lunatic. And when I made the discovery that the book was based on, it seemed so implausible, but also so exciting, that the ancient Celts had mapped and organized their vast territories in Western Europe by adapting the Greek system of latitude and longitude, and that they used this grid line system to determine the location of battles and settlements and the pattern of tribal migrations. I realized that the only way to approach it, since it was so implausible, was to try to disprove it, as a scientist should do, because the more thrilling a theory, the more you want it to be true and the less you can trust your own findings. And I'd spent about the first year of research trying to do that and failed. More and more subsidiary discoveries added themselves to the original one that I felt I was on the right track. But before I say a bit more about the discovery, which I'll just mention very briefly because it doesn't quite lend itself to a public lecture, I'll just say something about the background, because a lot of this was not clear to me when I started on the book. When I told people I was working on the Celts in Britain, several people said, well, you have dark hair and your parents are Scottish, so you must be a Celt, and that's perfect, good subject. And at that time, I had two German friends staying with me, and one of them is a very tall, blonde, blue-eyed Bavarian. And his friend said, no, you're not a Celt. He's a typical Celt. And when I told my French agent about this, she told me about her friend who's Spanish, and she has red hair and freckles, and her friends in Spain say she's a typical Celt. Now, this is a slightly risky thing to say at the moment where I live. I moved from Oxford to the English-Scottish border, and the house is almost surrounded by a river, and on the other side of the river is Scotland, literally a stone's throw away. And as you probably know, the people of Scotland, people who currently inhabit Scotland, will be voting soon on the question of independence. And so the question of Celticness often comes up. It's the idea that Scots are different from the English because of their Celtic heritage. In fact, there is no ancient Celtic DNA. The ancient Celts were simply the majority of the population of Western Europe in the late and early Iron Age, and they had in common a language or a group of languages, certain religious rituals, and what we recognize as Celtic art, but they were never a distinct ethnic group. otherwise, it would be very difficult to explain how a group of people who came, say, from Eastern Europe or the Eastern Alps managed to populate a continent within a few generations. The best example of this is Ireland, which, according to the archaeological record, wasn't settled or invaded by any group of people in the Celtic Age, say from about 800 BC. And so the question to be asked about the Irish Celts is not where did they come from, but when did Ireland become Celtic? Interestingly, the ancient Celts themselves seem to have believed that they had several different origins. According to one legend, some of them were indigenous, some of them were fugitives from the Trojan War, and some of them came from the outermost islands. We don't know where the outermost islands were, but it could be southern Scandinavia or possibly the Scottish Highlands. And others were children of the god Hercules, who was also a Celtic god or had a Celtic equivalent. Now, the ethnic view of the Celts, which is currently actively promoted by some Scottish nationalists, would have been instantly recognisable to a Roman, based as it is on Roman prejudice and propaganda. For the Romans, the Celts were barbaric, mud-smeared hooligans who had bloodthirsty priests called Druids who practised human sacrifice. The Romans were prepared to believe almost anything about the Celts. The Roman historian Cassius Dio, for example, claimed that the Caledonians, the Celts of northern Britain, lived off roots and bark and were capable of surviving for days on end in swamps with only their heads above water, which is potentially quite a useful ability when you're fighting the Romans. And you can see in some of the texts about the ancient Celts some of the earliest signs of a sense of humour filtered through usually the Roman writers. Julius Caesar has a wonderful passage in his book on the Gallic War, in which he explains how he effectively exterminated several Celtic tribes who lived in Gaul. And he was told various things about the vast Hercynian forest, remnants of which survive from pretty much the Alps to the great Hungarian plain. And he was told about a creature called the Alces, or the elk, which had no joints in its leg, which meant that it couldn't lie down to sleep. And so to sleep, it would lean against a tree trunk. And the hunters of the elk would simply saw through most of the base of the tree trunk so that when the elk went to sleep on the tree, it would fall over and be unable to get up. He reported this quite seriously. Even in Gaul, which is roughly the same as modern France, the Celts were said by the Romans to wear either animal skins or nothing, which is particularly unlikely in the northern parts of the Celtic world. They drank undiluted wine and wore trousers instead of a toga. This was in the part of Gaul known as Gallia Brachata, or trousered Gaul. Further north, in Gallia Comata, or hairy Gaul, they were said to kill each other at feasts, fighting over the best cut of meat. And since Celtic aristocrats never shaved their upper lips, according to Diodorus Siculus, their moustaches become entangled in the food, and when they are drinking, the beverage passes through a kind of strainer. Greek travellers, however, painted a rather different picture. The Greek writer Timagenes, who went to Gaul to research a history of the Celts, said, "You will never see in all these countries a man or a woman, however poor, either dirty or in rags." And that's a very striking statement, because there are very few countries in the world today about which that could be said. By the time Caesar landed in Britain in 55 BC, even the northern Celts, we now know, were living in warm, well-insulated houses. Structural archaeologists have shown that some of their timber mansions were greater feats of engineering than any Greek or Roman temple. Wealthy Britons drank wine from wine glasses and snacked on Mediterranean olives. They also had well-planned towns, which were divided into different districts, residential, industrial, and religious. And it's significant that Caesar himself wrote his book on the Gallic War in a Celtic town, in what he called a large and well-supplied oppidum, or town, in what's now Burgundy, where he decided to spend the winter instead of returning to the comfort of Rome. And this is one of the many facts about the Celts which seems to have slipped between the floorboards of history, that one of the great classics of world literature was written in an Iron Age town. Now, it's hard to say, or it'd be extremely complicated to try to work out why the Roman view of the Celts has prevailed. But there is a tendency to believe that if a civilization is defeated militarily, it must somehow have been inferior or have had an inherent weakness. And I was in the museum at Vienne, south of Lyon in the Rhone Valley, which I knew had a fantastic collection of Celtic gold coins, which are among the most beautiful objects in the ancient world. And they weren't on display. There was plenty of 18th century pottery, but no Celtic coins. And the deputy curator was there, and I asked her why the coins weren't on display, and she said, the director thought that no one would be interested. And I had found this lack of interest in the real traces of the Celts in France, and I said, why is there this lack of interest in your Celtic ancestors? And she said, parce qu'ils ont perdu, because they lost to the Romans. one thing you often see in museums, also in Britain, is that the Celts were illiterate. They were an illiterate society. This is based entirely on Julius Caesar's statement that the Druids considered it sacrilegious to commit their teachings to writing. And they passed it on in the form of verse, which was memorized. But he then went on to say that in almost all other matters, public as well as private, they used the Greek alphabet. He himself saw detailed population censuses written in Greek characters by Celtic scribes, and writing implements have been found all over the Celtic world. A custom reported by Diodorus Siculus suggests that literacy rates were unusually high. He said the Celts cast letters to their relatives onto funeral pyres in the belief that the dead will be able to read them. And in fact, one of our main sources on the extinct language of continental Celtic is the spindle weights and curse tablets that survived because of the material they used. The spindle weights were used as love tokens, and the lover would etch a message into them. And they show that even relatively uneducated ancient Celts knew how to read and write. In fact, one of the very few complete sentences of continental Celtic to have survived, says Nata Vimpi Kormi Da, which means pretty girl, give me some beer. It was obviously a relatively uneducated person because the Celts were otherwise very fond of red wine. Now, I don't know if this phrase is used much in the States, but in Britain you often hear people say, as every schoolchild knows, and it's often followed by something rather obscure, like the date of a battle or the plot of a Shakespeare play. But one thing every British schoolchild actually does know, because it's on the national curriculum, is that civilization in Britain began with the Romans, and that until the Romans arrived, there were no proper roads. This idea is so firmly rooted that even archaeologists will sometimes reinterpret the physical evidence to fit the presumed reality. In Perthshire, where the Scottish Highlands begin, a very narrow-rimmed wheel of ashwood was found, and part of the cart that it had belonged to. And the archaeologists said that with such a narrow rim, which was quite a feat of engineering, it wouldn't have gone very far. It would have become bogged down in the mud, which would imply stupidity on the part of the person who nonetheless had the amazing ability to produce a very narrow rim of ashwood. And we do know from written sources that long before the Roman conquest, merchants were racing from the Mediterranean all the way across Gaul to the English Channel in under 30 days. Even in the 18th century, the same journey using larger horses took only a few days less. Beautifully engineered chariots have been found in Celtic graves from northern England to the Rhineland. They had wide-angle steering and were clearly not built for rubbly trails. The Romans themselves had been so impressed by the Celtic carts and carriages when they first encountered them in the 4th century BC that they adopted the new technology and abandoned their own antiquated carts, which is why nearly all the Latin words for wheeled vehicles, chariot, cart, carriage, and so on, come from Celtic. And this is, incidentally, one reason why the Romans were keen to make the Celts look ridiculous, because the Celtic army had marched into Rome in 387 BC and plundered it, sacked it. And this was at the time when the Celts had occupied northern Italy and colonized it. So that Milan, Bologna, Brescia, Turin are all Celtic names. And that humiliation, the sack of Rome by Celtic army, was never forgotten, even when the barbarians had been driven back over the Alps. And so when Julius Caesar eventually brought genocide and slavery to Gaul, there were few voices in Rome raised in protest. Another telltale fact is that nearly all the settlements which lie along Roman roads have Celtic names and have been shown by archaeologists to have been there before the Romans. And so one would have to believe that the Celts thoughtfully arranged their towns in straight lines so that when the Romans arrived, they could simply join them all together. It is mostly Caesar who's to blame for this particular view of the Celts. He knew that in the comfort of Rome, his readers would imagine impenetrable, rain-soaked realms ravaged by mudslides and torrents, pretty much like the current English view of Scotland, it must be said, or Southern English view, obstructed by trackless swathes of tangled oak forest. And to a Mediterranean eye, an oak forest always looks wild and tangled because of the nature of the tree. He knew that as the Romans blessed him for bringing gold and slaves from Gaul, they would marvel at his bridge-building exploits and his lightning marches from one end of the wild land to the other. And yet Caesar found roads and bridges in place wherever he went. Otherwise, one would have to believe that the Celts gave the name Briva, which means bridge, to dozens of places in Gaul and Britain. Briva meant bridge, and then waited for the Romans to come and build the eponymous bridge. And the roads were evidently unusually good because the marching speed of the Roman legions in Gaul was well above the average for the Roman Empire. Now, if Celtic expertise did come from somewhere else and wasn't home-produced, it came not from Rome but from Greece. Long before there was a Roman Empire, in 600 BC, the port of Massalia, Marseille, was founded by Greek traders. They also founded several other emporia along the Mediterranean coast of Gaul. To supply the new ports, they bought land from local tribes and then divided up the territory into squares of equal size. And this has been very cleverly shown by on-the-ground and also aerial archaeology. The process and the result are known as centuriation. Some of the early Greek centuriations have been plotted in great detail on a map where they look like the grid lines of American cities, but covering many hundreds of square kilometres. And this is why the initial discovery that gave rise to this book is not as implausible as it might seem. I was originally planning a cycling expedition along the Heraclean Way, which was the route that the god Hercules was supposed to have taken from the ends of the earth at the extreme southwestern tip of Spain, all the way across Mediterranean Gaul to the Alps, where he created the pass known as Mont Genèvre, or Matrona, to the Celts. And as I plotted the route and worked out which sites of interest there would be along it, I realised that a lot of different places associated with Hercules in Gaul lay exactly on this route. And in addition, several tribal capitals seem to have been positioned on exactly that trajectory. And the third remarkable thing was that this trajectory is oriented on the rising sun of the summer solstice. Now, in Britain, I don't know how many neo-druids there are in the States, but we have quite a few in Britain. And the solstice has become a kind of obsession with people who don't just enjoy mysteries, but they also enjoy turning verifiable historical information back into a mystery. but we know that the Celts and sometimes the Romans and also the Etruscans very commonly oriented their streets and temples on the solstice. And the reason is that as a surveyor or an engineer, you need a fixed point. And of course, the sun never stands still except at the solstice, which means the standstill of the sun. Because in midsummer and midwinter, for about 7 to 10 days in a row, the sun rises in almost exactly the same place, so that you can, even if you have a day of cloud and rain, you can still take accurate bearings. And of course, this would also have a religious importance that would be indistinguishable from the practical importance. So the theoretical basis for an accurate map did exist. The fundamental problem was not theoretical, but practical. The Greek Eratosthenes, for instance, had measured, we don't quite know how accurately, the circumference of the earth, but he was working with only two assistants. If he'd been able to collate the findings of several hundred trained observers who remained at their posts for several years, like parish priests, he would have been able to produce something definitely a lot more accurate. And this is where the dreaded Druids come in. The Druids had the most comprehensive education system in the ancient world. It could take 20 years to become a Druid, which is as long as it takes to go from nursery school to a doctoral degree. We know they were schooled in mathematics, natural philosophy, surveying, astronomy, political science, as well as religion. The Druids were the intelligentsia of the ancient Celts. And one of the few Druids known to us by name, Diviciacus, was not a white-robed wizard of the sort you see in Victorian illustrations. He was a scholar and a diplomat who was one of the very few non-Romans to address the Roman Senate. And when he did that, he stayed with Cicero at his home on the Palatine Hill in Rome and wrote a eulogy to his host. And if you're interested in what the real Druids did, there are two chapters in the book which reconstruct the Druidic syllabus, divided into elementary and advanced. And I think I can say that even the advanced syllabus requires only the basic mathematics that every school child knows. And perhaps I'll leave it there. Does that leave enough time for Q&A? Okay, good. I mean, I can also ask my own questions. But I will just mention one detail about the Druids to show that the mathematics isn't very advanced. All over the Celtic world, their shrines and other enclosures took recognisable forms which looked like a rectangle drawn by a clumsy child or an incompetent surveyor. They're very peculiar shapes which don't appear to correspond to anything. And when I was working on this book and realised how much the Druids knew about Greek mathematics and Euclidean geometry, eventually I discovered that this is the shape that indicates the process of drawing an ellipse. It's where you take two focal points. You can do it with pins and a loose piece of thread. You have two pins, the loose piece of thread, and then you put a pencil against the thread and draw around it, keeping it taut, and you'll produce a perfect ellipse. And that's a very typically Celtic thing to do, because their art is very often just a part of a much bigger pattern, which you can deduce from the small item, but which isn't apparent when you just see that one item. And so their temples were implicit ellipses, and the significance of that, as they knew from Pythagoras, was that this is the yearly pattern of the sun's course throughout the year. And this, in turn, is very similar to some of the early Christian rituals, which we know were derived from Celtic practices, where saints such as St. Patrick and St. Columba would process sunwise, or in the direction of the sun, around the well that was to be consecrated, or the church that was to be consecrated. And that's about as complicated as the mathematics gets. Yes? What they seem to have done, because you very rarely have a completely flat horizon, is to use a standardized solstice angle. Because as you move further north, the angle of the solstice sun changes. So it depends on which latitude you're at. And, of course, it wouldn't have worked. It would have been impossibly complicated if you then had to have an exact reading of the solstice. And so what they did was use a ratio that corresponded to more or less the place where the sun rises at that time of year. And in Gaul, and these ratios were had an obvious importance in Euclidean geometry. So in Britain it was 4-3. Which corresponds more to the angle of the sun in Britain, so that when you constructed your grid, you were you had perfect Pythagorean triangles, sides 4-3 and 5. In Gaul, it was 11-7, which produces pi divided by 2, which they would have known from Greek mathematics. So it was a beautifully coherent system, but it wasn't. It wasn't insanely localized. It was something with which all the tribes could agree. And it's more a survey line than a road. The Heraclean Way is, in certain sections, an actual road. It's a motorway which follows the line of the Roman Via Domitia. In other parts, it's just a dirt track which you can cycle along or walk. And in other parts, because only a god can smash his way through the rock, as Hercules did. It's the trajectory exists. So it's like a survey line of a Roman road, where you have two terminal points and an exact bearing from point A to point B. And then you try to keep the road as close as possible to the survey line, there are a lot of good examples in Britain where the road will rarely deviate more than, say, 3 miles from the survey line. And incidentally, this also answers one of the peculiar facts about the Roman road system in Britain, which is how did the Romans manage to project their survey line from a part of Britain they had conquered to a part of Britain that had not been subdued? I mean, it's done today in Afghanistan, but obviously with global positioning devices. But if the survey line already existed, and if this already was an established route, then that would explain how the Romans seemed to manage to construct a road system before they'd reached that part of the country, and also how they managed to do it so quickly. Yes? Yes, I will. Well, what I'm really hoping will happen is there'll be a lucrative trade in contraband whiskey. And there's a little island in the middle of the river which can be a customs post, I suppose. I think there's a romantic fascination with the past in Scotland, which is understandable. But Scotland is currently one of the few countries in Europe where medieval history, because it doesn't go back much further than that, is talked about in the same breath as modern politics. And that's despite the example of Ireland, just a few miles away across the Irish Sea. So there's a deliberate misunderstanding of recent history. But it's not really... I don't think it's going to affect the outcome, although... Yes.
Well, Herodotus wrote about a lot of different people, the Persians and so on. What did he say about the Celts?
Yes, Herodotus wrote about a lot of different peoples in the ancient world. What did he say about the Celts? Well, I said in the book that he was like a traveller on a starless night holding up a candle to the landscape. He'd heard about the Celtoi, and he said they dwell at the extreme western edge of Europe near a place called Pyrene, where the Danube has its source. And he was referring to places which are 1,000 miles apart. But it's very curious. It would be wonderful to know the source of his information. But we do know that at that time there were Celtic tribes living in the far southwest of Spain and in the region where the Danube has its source. And that's certainly the first example of someone trying to pin the Celts down to a particular locality and find out where they came from. Well, this initially there was the contact with Greece was fairly limited. It was just along the Mediterranean coast, and Herodotus didn't always collate his different sources of information. And in fact, one of the many things we don't know about the Celts is whether they called themselves Celts. They acquired that name. But that's obscure too. Herodotus was... one of the things that struck me working on the book was what a very clear divide there was between different disciplines, so that we know that navigators had a good sense of the geography of Western Europe, inevitably, because if you were trading from Spain to Ireland and Britain, you knew more or less where you were going. And they used navigational techniques which were very similar to those used by Columbus. whereas geographers belong more to the humanities, so to speak. So that Caesar's conception, the conception of Roman commanders of the geography of Western Europe was seriously skewed. They thought, in fact, Agricola wanted to conquer Ireland because he thought that if you crossed Ireland and got to the other side, you would then be looking at Spain. It now seems astonishing when, now that information is so transferable between different disciplines on the whole, that these misconceptions could have existed even in the mind of a military commander. Yes?
You said that there was practiced human sacrifice. Can you say something about that?
Yes. I foolishly tried to explain to an audience in Britain that there was nothing wrong with human sacrifice in context. and that there was a difference between random violence and the kind of military violence that was perpetrated by Caesar, who deliberately wiped out certain tribes by mutilating all male members of it, and violence that was perpetrated as part of a religious ritual that was accepted by a particular society. And I don't want to condone human sacrifice, but it is one of the things that shows what a very distant age this is. And we can't expect to have an accurate subjective impression of it. It sounds as though they used human sacrifice as a form of propitiation. So it was, a lot of other people were doing it. Yes?
Could you say something about the god Lou in Celtic? I understand there's a god Lou who transmogrifies into Saint-Louis in France, and it's a long line. Mm. Or is that off your topic?
No, he seems to have been the main Celtic god. And one of the things the Druids seem to have done is to organize the religions of each particular tribe and create a kind of Celtic religion. And Lu, or it's usually written L-U-G or L-U-G-H, the name of that god is the basis of a lot of places. Lugdunum is Lyon. There's a possibility that London was also derived from it. And as you say, he was transformed into other gods and saints, as a lot of other Celtic gods were. It's very frustrating because that is one of the aspects of the Celtic world we don't know much about. There's a horned god, for example, called Cernunnos, but that's just based on one representation of a god who may have had horns or antlers, and the inscription is truncated. But Cernunnos has become a figure of the modern Celtic pantheon. Yes, sir. Yes, it's a very good question. And there are definite similarities between the Etruscans and the Celts, and it may be that division is too absolute. And we know from some Roman surveying texts that the Etruscans did also use solstice measurements in creating their towns, and that the town would be arranged so that there was a lucky quarter and the unlucky quarter and so on. And of course, there was a lot of trade between the Etruscans and the Celts, especially after the Celts had colonized northern Italy. But I'm not much of an expert on the Etruscans, but you are right that there are clearly similarities. The big division that the Romans made between the Celts and their neighbours was the Celts and the Ligurians, who lived along the coast in the hilly parts of the Côte d'Azur, which are still very difficult to get to. But there's one of the nice things about this field is that archaeology is turning up new evidence a lot of the time, so we can still hope that we'll know more about the Etruscans one day. I think, were you
yes,
first?
Could you just describe a bit more the Celtic road in Spain?
In
Spain, didn't you mention that the Celtic road ran in Spain?
Yes, or rather the trajectory did.
From the Mediterranean.
Yes. Since it wasn't necessarily a road, but more a trajectory, so in some parts it would have been a road. The main thing that we know about the Heraclean Way in Spain is that Hannibal followed the path when he marched his elephants over the Pyrenees, through southern Gaul, and over the Alpine Pass, about which a lot has been written, and several elephants have been experimentally driven over ridiculously high passes in the Alps. And we know that Hannibal crossed the Alps in November. And we know quite a lot about his march because a Greek historian went to Gaul to retrace the route when there were still people living who had seen the elephants or whose fathers had seen Hannibal pass through. And if you look at the speeches that are reported by Roman writers, especially Livy and Polybius, we don't know exactly what their sources were, but you can see that even though they didn't know what the significance was, that Hannibal was presenting himself as the man who followed in the footsteps of the sun god Hercules. And the Carthaginians had their own equivalent of Hercules, who's recognizably the same god. And so there is good evidence of someone recognizing the importance of the Heraclean Way. It's a very logical route. If you're walking or cycling over the Alps, the easiest route is the pass that the Heraclean Way follows over the Mont Genève, which is usually free of snow, even in November when he crossed the Alps. And similarly in the Pyrenees, it's a logical route that he would have taken. Yes?
Two questions. First, is Stonehenge a Celt development? And the second question is, what kinds of further evidence would you hope to stumble upon or find to further nail down your theories?
Yes, that's a very good question. Well, the first question is, Stonehenge belonged to the Neolithic period, and so to the ancient Celts, Stonehenge would have been a mysterious ancient monument. They might have recognized solstitial solar alignments in it, but they themselves didn't usually build in stone. There's some archaeological evidence that Celtic people visited Stonehenge, but they wouldn't have known anything about the people who built it. And their own lines of solstice and latitude and longitude were the hinges of a new age. They were built more by mind than muscle. And then your second question is very tricky. I have no idea. But as I said, the nice thing about working in archaeology is that new information is coming up all the time. And the dictionary of the extinct form of Celtic, known as Continental Celtic, very often has new additions because new words are coming up all the time. And it's a shame for the very decent Frenchman who's been preparing the dictionary, because the majority of those words are obscenities because they often come from love tokens and curse tablets. But he has wonderful circumlocutions for letting you know what the word probably meant. Yes.
Association of Druids with Neolithic structures and circles and hinges and that kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah. They. There's the 18th century association of Druids with prehistoric structures and henges is an invention, and yes, it certainly is. There's no known continuity between those prehistoric cultures and the Celts, but we can assume that they were interested in them and that they certainly would have known about them. Yes. Those are very good questions too. Yes, to take the second question first, there were academies. We know that there were schools in Autun in particular. There was a very famous university about, 1,500 years before the Sorbonne was founded, where there was a map of the world hanging in the porticos. so there were, and your first question was... communication, yeah. About other peoples, we don't know, but the Celtic world itself was vast. And what we do know is that they were very good at forming alliances between different tribes, and this is what amazed Julius Caesar when he was trying to conquer Gaul. And in fact, the major Celtic tribes in Gaul founded a monetary union thousands of years before the Eurozone and set up exchange rates with Marseille and Rome. Could function very well as a political unit that in some ways was more stable than France until relatively recently. Well, the writing that did survive is mostly on lead and stone, but they would have used they used wax tablets. So we have found there is evidence for the use of wax tablets.
We have time for just one more quick question.
What are the sources for most of what you know about this?
Is
it mostly Roman?
Yes, a lot of it's Roman, but then Roman's quite a capacious term. It's Roman and Greek primarily. And of course there are large gaps in it, but there is a lot of good evidence. So there are about 20 writers who say useful things about the Druids. And, of course, that makes it possible to compare and collate the different pieces of written evidence. And then there's also the archaeological evidence, which is growing all the time, which matches the written record very well. So it's primarily the written record, the texts that have survived, and the archaeological record. And place name evidence, too, is very important.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I just wanted to remind everyone that there are books for sale. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are outside. Thank you once again to Graham Robb and for Larry Bergreen for introducing our speaker tonight. So get home safe. Thank you.
Thank you.